Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, is America facing a human rights crisis with its immigration policy? But first, we continue our exploration of the future of food. With climate change, contamination, and a host of stressors on the planet, how will we feed a growing population? What are the politics of food? This panel was recorded in front of a live audience. This was part two of a three-part series on the future of food. You can listen to the first parts at scholarcircle.org.
My name is Manuel Valle. I'm a senior lecturer here in the sociology department at the University of Auckland, and I'm a co-organizer for this symposium along with Maria Armudian. We have an excellent panel to discuss food-related issues. We have Anastasia Telesetsky, who's a senior lecturer in the Faculty of Law at the University of Auckland. She's co-authored and co-edited the books The International Law of Disaster Relief and Marine Pollution Contingency Planning, State Practices in Asia-Pacific States. Nick Lewis is an associate professor in the School of Environment at the University of Auckland. He co-edited the book Biological Economies, Experimentation, and the Politics of Agri-Food Frontiers. Richard Lehrheran is a professor of geography in the School of Environment at this university. He has co-authored and co-edited books including Knowledge, Industry, and Environment, and Agri-Food, Commodity Chains, and Globalizing Networks. And Michael Carolyn is a professor of sociology and the associate dean of research for the College of Liberal Arts at Colorado State University. He's authored and co-edited books including Reclaiming Food Security, The Real Cost of Cheap Food, as well as Biological Economies, Experimentation, and Politics of Agri-Food Frontiers. So with no further ado, I hand it off to Maria.
Thank you, Manuel Valle. Nicholas Lewis, you've said two things. One of them is about the globalization of food and what that has done. The other is about how really, even when we think we're eating alone, we're not eating alone, because there are all of those people that were involved in the production and the delivering and et cetera, of the food. So I think I'm going to throw the first one over to Richard Lehrheran about globalization interacting with the individual and with the community and what that interaction is and does to our choices and what we ultimately see.
When we speak of globalization, we should also think about localization, because things are very genuinely connected. The first observation I'd make is that New Zealand almost is running at a disadvantage with respect to selling abroad. And so the connections by way of ecological scrutiny and feedback in that sense from market trends, which might be influenced by diet and such like, take a little longer to filter this way and such like. The second thing I think that is really important is that, in a sense, returning to the dairy example is probably helpful, is that what we're actually talking about is different values and expressions of those values through different means or practices or procedures of doing things. And then that, in the end, does sum up to there may be some different sorts of wider outcomes.
Can you give us some examples to make it more concrete?
Yeah, sure, sure. Well, I mean, in the case of biological agriculture, dairying, those who are committed to that will have a modest application of different fertilisers. They do an enormous amount of testing on a daily basis. And, you know, dairy farmers in New Zealand do a lot of testing, but these guys are just besotted by it. And so they really understand what's happening in the soil, because the soil translates into plant nutrition qualities, and that translates into what happens to the herd and what happens to milk quality. So ultimately, to pick up on a word that I don't think was... No, it was mentioned once in the first session, the word practices is really, really critical. And, of course, Nick's example of the seafood industry gets us right to that. We are committed to transparency. Now, transparency is a practice, a political practice, that allows others to engage in the conversation, to actually perhaps engage in some co-learning over the matter, and perhaps define different sorts of commitments and so on, to take Mike's point through in terms of not quite making people do things, but at least opening pathways that allow people to arrive at more informed decisions and choices about what they might do.
Well, Michael, Carolyn, that brings you in twice. One is, first of all, that idea that you expressed in your book about eating alone, which is that we're not really eating alone. Nobody's really eating alone, even if you're sitting in your office with your lunch on your desk. There are a lot of people involved in that. But it sounds like what you're arguing is, you know, since there are so many people involved in that, maybe we need to connect the dots. So maybe walk us through first what you mean by we're never eating alone, and then connect that to the second point that you've been trying to make, which is how do we get from point A to point B?
How we're not eating alone, where to even begin? I'll just give a couple examples. So she's referencing a book that had come out a few months ago called No One Eats Alone, Food as a Social Enterprise. And part of the book involves interviewing a whole host of CEOs and executives from various Fortune 500 firms, as well as interviewing food activists to try to kind of get both sides and try to tell a story about what it all means. And what was so interesting is there were even elements of our food system that I didn't even realize existed. And I've been studying it for close to 20 years now. I mean, I talked to a manager of an industrial vitamin plant in China, which was fascinating because, you know, all of our food is fortified with industrial vitamins. And we never think about where those industrial vitamins come in. We're so busy kind of tracing our food from fork to source, never even asking or even thinking to ask, where do the vitamins come from that produce that food? And he was telling me how most of their vitamin D comes from the lanolin of sheep from Australia. And so there's this crazy link from sheep and lanolin going from Australia, going to China, and being turned into vitamin D and going in all of our food that's being, and I never got an answer, but if I think organic milk, at least in the States, it's fortified with vitamin D that comes from lanolin from sheep, it's still considered organic, even though the vitamin D is not. But there's just these really fascinating connections. The other one, I talked to someone who's in the industrialized salmon business, and he showed me a paint deck. If anyone's seen those, it's one of those things that fans out and gives you all the colors of the rainbow when you're painting your house. And he showed me literally one of those and told me that you can pick the flesh of your salmon to any one of these colors, and then that determines the feed and the feed ratio. So you can select your flesh colors as well. And so there's all these kooky, fascinating stories about our food system that you just never even think about. I mean, that was my point about there's all these people involved in our food system. Yes, there's the farmers and there's the workers, but then there's the managers of vitamin D plants in China and people that you go to pick the flesh color of your salmon. So then it gets to the question, how do we get people to have a politics, you know, that they begin to realize that we are indeed eating alone? And we need a politics that kind of draws us outward, as opposed to what I see, we currently have a politics that more drives us inward. And I make this argument in part based upon my interviews with these individuals from big food firms too, in that how they were readily admitting that they're co-opting some of these narratives about the importance of feeding your family healthy food. You know, these are things that corporations can co-opt and profit from. And they are. I mean, look at the branding of health claims that surround all of our packaging. So they can get behind a lot of those things. And they talk about that. I mean, look at their branding. You deserve a break today, right? McDonald's famous one. I have people talking about how they're trying to co-opt slow food. Not that McDonald's has anything to do with slow food, but this notion that your life is too fast, as Annie talked about, you need to slow down, come to McDonald's, and we can do that for you. And so they're very much focused on these politics that bring you inward, think about yourself, maybe they get you to think about your family. They have no interest in engaging in a politics to get you thinking about the worker that's on the other side of McDonald's making minimum wage and trying to feed three kids, or the workers on the other side of the globe that are being exposed to harmful chemicals. They have no interest in that sort of politics. And so I'm really interested in those practices that begin to shift eaters from having this politics of looking inward, which is to some degree what we are as kind of consumers. We're fixated upon what the nutrition facts label says. We're fixated upon price. We're fixated upon making sure our family eats healthy, nutritious food, which is all important. But we're intentionally not socialized to look outward to think about some of those other things too. And I think that's the type of politics we need to think more about as well. The politics that draws us out as opposed to the politics that forces us to look inward in terms of how we look, self-image, and things like that.
Seems like that sort of rugged individual look has been exported from the United States, frankly, where we got you from. Anastasia Telesetsky, I know you've seen some of these alternative models as well.
Sure.
What have you learned from them?
Sure, and I'll speak to that in a moment, but I just wanted to respond quickly. I think one of the really key issues here is really thinking about labeling, though, and transparency, because we have a right to know. We have a right to know where our food is being sourced from. And I'm really interested in the idea of creating, and this is an opportunity for New Zealand to create sustainability labeling. What would that look like? You know, there's a lot of ongoing, this is, you know, up in, and academics talk about it all the time, but what would it look like actually to make a label that tells us that, no, that chocolate bar you just ate was not harvested from cacao beans that young child slaves had collected, you know, because the reality of the chocolate industry, for those of you who may not be familiar, is that for many years, particularly in the Côte d'Ivoire, many of the people collecting the chocolate, the cacao beans, were children who had been seized from their families with promises of great things, including an education, and they would find themselves harvesting beans for 3 to 4 years. And there's many stories like this, including in the fishing industry. So that's something I would see as really part of the future of food, is that when we pick up a food, if we can't have that trust relationship, because one of the things you can't have is something like a farmer's market as an alternative model, wherein you know who the producer is because there he or she is standing in front of you. And you can ask the kind of questions you want to ask. And this model is catching on. It's not particularly prevalent here in our urban centers. But one of the models I've seen that's been truly remarkable is urban agriculture or peri-urban agriculture. Most people today in the world live in urban centers. And one of the questions is, most people in the urban world are now depending on rural areas. And our global footprint as a species has really put pressure, a lot of anthropogenic pressures on environmental systems. And so there is now a push to do more and more food production in cities. This is both from an environmental perspective, but frankly, it's also a risk assessment issue where we want to be thinking about national security. You want to be thinking how if you have a large population, you know, how will you be ensuring that people can eat? And so there's been some remarkable work done. I commend you to look at Detroit, Michigan, a city that truly is greening itself and doing some remarkable community-based and for-profit urban agriculture. Because I think it's key. I am very much a supporter of community gardens, and I think they answer many needs. I'm very much a supporter of school gardens, but I think this has to be part, it has to be systematized to be part of our economy, part of our urban economy.
Nicholas Lewis, what do you say to that?
What do I say to that? I'll say two things to that. The first thing I would say is that it's an interesting I don't think it's a tension or necessarily a contradiction, but there's a difference between a politics of the individual that we appeal to through choice and consumer practice, and a politics of collectivity or a collective politics that we somehow foster in other kinds of ways. And my initial response is that we had laid before us two different forms of politics, and the important thing there is that we need to treat that politically in terms of and. We need to do both those kinds of politics and those practices. We need to search for the very difficult political responses of the collective, as well as doing all we can through standard market practices to generate a politics of the individual. And I'll draw you your attention to a little example that might illustrate the importance of putting the politics of a collective into that. With the Sustainable Seas Challenge, I'm doing some work trying to stimulate a blue economy, an economy that is based on a set of practices that pay significant attention to intergenerational prosperity as well as profit today, that pay significant attention to questions of sustainability and ecosystem health. And one of the things that we're trying to do through that project is to catalogue the multiple different types of practices, some communicated and advertised, practices that are sustainable, that actually correspond to that conception of a blue economy. practices that are advertised and made a lot of, but some practices that go on within small enterprises, bigger enterprises, even global enterprises. Little practices that are a bit different. And one of the things that I found really quite fascinating was to put this to a few people working in the seafood industry at the top of the South Island, and to learn that people will routinely go out and seed the commons with mussels. So they'll put spat into the commons. And I'm thinking, hey, what a wonderful kind of practice, because it begins to point to one of the essential problems in all of this, and that is property rights. And one of the neat things about doing stuff around the sea is that the property rights are not clarified in quite the same way and defined in quite the same way as they are on land. So I think we can look to these kind of coastal areas for some examples of how people have to grapple with the commons and with the individual, and how to grapple with the management of environment-economy relations in that kind of context, because it's quite a complicated context. And I think that tells us a lot, not just about New Zealand, but about things happening elsewhere in the world where property rights aren't quite what we assume them to be on farms, for example.
Richard Leheron.
Yes, a couple of points. The transparency debate is about to shift, I think, in New Zealand as we get into gene editing. I was at a workshop last week, and the discussion was focusing on healthcare and on pest control. But it also moved beyond those two domains to the bigger kinds of questions. And what you've actually got is an increasing capacity to make some changes relatively easily and at low cost. But it's likely to be on such a broad scale. So, you know, a food question is not going to be in isolation. It's going to have all sorts of other further dimensions that are
like
sitting
what,
there.
Like what, for example?
Yeah.
Like, so you say food would be connected to another dimension. What would be an example of that?
Obviously healthcare, but also, especially in the New Zealand context, what are some of the pests that are here that might be worked on through the instrumentation of genetic gene editing? And what I think that begins to raise is the fact that we are literally going to move into sort of an unknown landscape of ethical questions that we've not really had before. And just to wrap that particular example off, one commentator at this workshop mentioned that it's possible to get gene editing kits for children, primary age children, and in the US. And so you start to think, okay, well, this is not just a question for the oldies and the middle-aged and such like. It's going to transcend things in a whole set of quite new ways. And I'd be interested in hearing your comments around rights and expectations associated with that, because I suspect that food politics is going to have some very new kinds of dimensions.
Because of this genetic alteration.
Coupled with other things, yeah.
Yeah, and certainly we've had the conversation about modifying foods genetically already to some degree, but you're right, it's reaching yet another level where we're going to have to face all of these questions. I just did not want to miss the opportunity, Michael Carolyn, to talk about sharing economy. And you've suggested that we've got some solutions there. If you could just give us one or two examples, that would be great.
Yeah, sure. So, I have a book coming out in a few months on the food as it relates to the sharing economy. And I guess this, to some degree, speaks about what Nick was talking about, too, the importance of experimenting when it comes to how we do economy, and then trying to learn from those experimentations as scholars, for instance. So one really quick example that I found really interesting that kind of also speaks to what Nick was referring to as kind of a collectivist politics versus an individualist politics. I had interviewed some farmers in North Dakota, conventional farmers growing corn and wheat. And I also had interviewed some urban cooperative members that were heading up a land and food cooperative. And I, among other things, I asked them, what does autonomy mean to you? And then I showed them a list of about 50 words that I had kind of that I thought they might respond to, think of responding to by the word autonomy, and the words were defined. And I asked them to select the five words of what autonomy means for them. And then when I did this, I created two different word clouds to represent how these two different populations thought about the term of autonomy. And the conventional farmers, their number one word that came up most often was independence. When I asked the cooperative members that question, their number one word was interdependence. And so I find this interesting to get back to my point about how I think sometimes our practices, who we interact with, how we interact with them, can lead not to just different understandings about simple things, but could potentially lead to different world views to some degree. A collectivist ontology versus an individualistic ontology, where you look at somebody and you think of them as a potential collaborator as opposed to a potential competitor, right? Where you believe in the we can all do better by getting at this together versus we have to all be at each other's throats. And again, that's something I found hopeful about the sharing economy is how some of these practices led to not just different behaviors, but led to very different what seemed like worldviews.
So I guess we're going to close on that now and thank our amazing panelists, Nicholas Lewis and Anastasia and Michael Carolyn and Richard Leheron. It has been a great pleasure to be sitting here in the moderator chair. Thanks.
For your great questions. Anastasia Telesetsky is a senior lecturer in the Faculty of Law at the University of Auckland. She's co-authored and co-edited the books The International Law of Disaster Relief and Marine Pollution Contingency Planning, State Practices in Asia Pacific States. Nick Lewis is an associate professor in the School of Environment at the University of Auckland. He co-edited the book Biological Economies, Experimentation, and the Politics of Agri-Food Frontiers. Richard Leheron is a professor of geography in the School of Environment at this university. He has co-authored and co-edited books including Knowledge, Industry, and Environment, and Agri-Food, Commodity Chains, and Globalizing Networks. And Michael Carolyn is a professor of sociology and the associate dean of research for the College of Liberal Arts at Colorado State University. He's authored and co-edited books including Reclaiming Food Security, The Real Cost of Cheap Food, as well as Biological Economies, Experimentation, and Politics of Agri-Food Frontiers. Thank you.
This was part two of a three-part series on the future of food. You can listen to the first parts at scholarcircle.org. When we come back, we explore the human rights implications of the U.S. immigration policies. Stay tuned. You are listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Is America facing a human rights crisis with its immigration policy? With reports of indefinite detentions and separating children from their families, we explore how we got here, what the legal and political ramifications are, and what happens next for America. We're joined by two experts. Kevin Johnson is Dean and Professor of Public Interest Law at the University of California, Davis Law School. His books include Opening the Floodgates, Why America Needs to Rethink Its Borders and Immigration Laws, and Immigration Law and the U.S.-Mexico Border. David Kyle is a professor of sociology at the University of California, Davis. His publications include Global Human Smuggling, Comparative Perspectives, and Transnational Peasants, Migrations, Networks, and Ethnicity in Andean Ecuador.
Welcome to the Scholar Circle. It's great to have the two of you back again. Perhaps what we need to do now is look at the most current events that are happening in the United States around immigration, detention, deportation, and put that into the broader context. The reports that I have been reading, and I'm certain you have too, have been around these detention centers and separating children from their families and photos of children in cages and raids of not just business places, but hospitals. Can we first talk about what is going on in these processes? And is this normal, Kevin Johnson?
Well, it's both normal and it's extraordinary. In some ways, it's normal because the Obama administration did utilize detention and removal in very aggressive ways. So it's nothing, you know, new in that respect. However, this administration and President Trump, as well as Attorney General Sessions, has made it clear that they were going to conduct what might be called a full court press on immigrants and removals and detentions. In the past, for example, President Obama had detained immigrant families in family detention centers, trying to keep the families together while their processes were proceeding. This administration, in an effort to deter asylum seekers from Central America from coming to the United States, is set forth a policy of destroying families, or at least separating families indefinitely. And that's gotten an extraordinary amount of press and in the United States, bipartisan criticism from Republicans and Democrats. I do think it's important to note that some of the detention practices, including using cages along the U.S.-Mexico border, were unfortunately common in previous administrations and are not all that new to this administration. But the separation of families is something that's very different, and it's part of an overall policy of this administration that they call zero tolerance toward undocumented immigrants.
I have read that they have actually lost something like 1,500 children, or at least lost the records of. They cannot figure out where they are. What do we know about that?
There have been reports of lost records, lost children, and we don't know for sure precisely what's going on. I assume there'll be some congressional and probably agency investigations trying to figure it out. But one of the problems in doing large numbers of detentions and splitting families up is keeping track of the people you have. And it's been a problem for a number of years in terms of detention, in terms of keeping track of people, keeping them healthy, and keeping them out of harm's way. So it's a problem that you'd expect to happen when you have hundreds of thousands of people being detained in any one year. But we don't know precisely what's going on with the, I've heard a number of figures, including as many as 1,500 children being misplaced in the juvenile foster care system.
David Kyle, what would you add?
Well, for one, I think that some of the information has been inaccurate. I'm not sure that it was on purpose. But so, for example, children held in cages, it turns out that some of those photos were from 2014. I think that there was a story about the 1,500 lost children that kind of bounced it out a little bit. I'm not sure that lost was exactly the right way. I want to add, though, that I agree with Kevin that this is both old and new. But what's really new about this is that one of our values embedded in immigration policy as a core American value are families. You know, we think of families first. And that's been one of those sacred dimensions of immigration. In fact, when the Trump administration talks about chain migration, really, that comes out of the social science literature in which we really talked about family migration, social networks. And that's always been something that, unlike other countries, we actually have put a lot of weight in keeping families together. And that's one of the reasons that we have these policies. So to break up children with families that are fine, they're not abusive, all they did was cross the border, this is really new and really goes against one of those fundamental values. And I think the only other thing I would add to that is that the old part of this is that this is a very deep ideological current. I would say social Darwinian ideology, eugenics. I'm not sure. I think racist is a very strong term, but I think it definitely is embedded in our culture that there's certain people that are desirable and some people that are not. And at that bottom end, it's okay to treat them sort of like animals. This is what you would do to animals. You can break them up, or for that matter, slaves.
I want to go down that path just a little bit more, and I think that Kevin's going to have some response to that as well. Some of the laws and policies he's looked at have reflected this a bit. But David, as a sociologist, looking at how you said, for example, the family has always been sort of revered, Do you think that this is a reflection of changing norms or changing values? Or do you think this is what you also added at the end, that there are exceptions to our values? And that is when we demonize a group or when we make them less than human or whatever that thing is that enables you to set aside your value. Which one is it, or is it both?
I think it's a great question. I think that before the 1965 immigration reform, we certainly valued families, but we restricted immigrants from a number, really entire continents, that were viewed as desirable. So I think your point is well taken. I think in this particular case, I don't think this is a change in norms. And I think that that's why we're seeing the pushback by even conservative Republican groups. A number of groups are pushing back as the stories are coming out. Some of the images, by the way, while they're not held in cages, they are being held in a former Walmart supercenter in Brownsville. And it's still fairly shocking that we would put so many, mostly young boys, just sort of all together, warehousing them, you know, quite literally. You know, there's something about this that's beyond the pale for most Americans. And I think that these are two deeply embedded ideologies, not exactly racism, but the idea that we should be able to control and manage the most desirable. And if they're not in that category, we can kind of do anything we want with them. That rubs up against the family value. And I think we're seeing both of these intersecting right now. It seems like just a few minutes ago, there's been some movement on this by various groups, including by the Republicans, to halt this.
Kevin Johnson, we're talking about race, we're talking about language, we're talking about law, and you happen to have written quite a bit on these intersections, including around even the languaging of, you know, illegal immigration and that becoming part of the lexicon. How do you see this connected in the same way that David does, or do you see it slightly different as a lawyer?
I absolutely see it connected in important ways. In the immigration laws, the sort of the DNA of the immigration laws is this concept of the alien. The alien has limited rights, has limited protections, can be subject to removal, can be treated in ways that citizens can never be treated. And I think that this term aliens has evolved over time in United States history. But today, alien, illegal alien, serve as code, a sort of racial code. And we think about today, the people who are affected by the American immigration laws, we should be aware that 90% of the people detained every year are people from Mexico and Central America. We should be aware that 95% or more of the people deported every year are from Mexico or Central America. So we have what some people might call a Latino removal system and a Latino detention system encoded in the immigration laws. Those racially disparate impacts occur even though the immigration laws don't talk expressly about race as they once did in United States history. At one time in U.S. history, we had laws that expressly excluded the Chinese from coming to this country, later expanded to include other groups from Asia. Today, we have what some would call colorblind immigration laws, but at the same time, they have disparate racial impacts. And one of the extraordinary things about this administration is that this president has made it clear that he has particular views about different groups of immigrants from particular countries who have particular racial and ethnic backgrounds. He's talked about people from El Salvador and Haiti as being from countries. He's talked about Mexican immigrants being prone to crime. And he's used kinds of phrases and terms and talked about groups and immigrant groups. He often invokes MS-13 as a sort of code for all Salvadorans or all Central Americans. So I think that it's important to keep in mind that race is underlying a lot of what's going on when it comes to immigration law and its enforcement, and is often employed as a code word for getting people that are disfavored in American society. And that's historically been the case, and I think it's the case today. And one of the extraordinary things to me is that President Trump talks about immigration and racial terms like no other president in the last 50 years. It's jarring to me to hear him talk about Mexicans as criminals and rapists, as all Salvadorans and as MS-13 members, to talk about Haiti and El Salvador as countries. It's like nothing we've seen in a good 50 years. In America, in 1954, President Eisenhower had a deportation operation known as Operation Wetback. It was focused on Mexican immigrants. I don't think we've seen anything like that kind of nomenclature or direct racial reference from Operation Wetback to President Trump. And it's kind of startling. If you would have said a few years ago it was possible that a high political figure would say something like he said on numerous occasions, I would have said no way, and I would have been dead wrong.
And it seems to have become accepted among his followers in particular, and maybe even, you know, supported in many ways, that kind of language. There's some scholars who are looking at this as he's saying what people were already thinking in a divided America, because we've got this divided America that political scientists have been pointing to for quite some time.
He's certainly talking to one segment of America through some kind of racial code. Some people might talk about it as dog whistle politics of sorts. But it is amazing to me how popular some of his statements are, including the statement about building a wall along the U.S.-Mexico border. And sort of build a wall became a chant at his campaign rallies, and a very powerful one in terms of loudness and enthusiasm of the crowd. But if you talk to most any immigration scholars, they would tell you that immigration enforcement may not be well served by a wall along the U.S.-Mexico border, that other devices might prove more useful in terms of immigration enforcement.
Let me turn to something and have you respond to something that David said. David was talking about how historically in U.S. culture and values, we've talked about the family as kind of the core, and that policies have been generally built around that. Now, I understand there is a new immigration policy on the table that is called merit-based. Does that take the family structure and turn it upside down? What happens with this policy?
I think I agree very much with David that we have a set of immigration laws that have been devoted to family reunification. We have a devotion in this country to the family. We have a Republican Party that in a number of important areas has emphasized family values, and the Republican Party often calls itself the Party of Family Values. So I do think the family is an important concept. And now we are seeing, however, sort of a reaction to that family reunification aspect of our immigration laws. We have a proposal that's been percolating in the U.S. Congress for about a year called the RAISE Act. It's a long acronym for a law that would reduce family immigration by half, would focus on what's called merit-based immigration, which would focus on language skills, education, and the kinds of things that aren't as prominent in our current immigration laws. Some would say that the real motivation behind the RAISE Act is to reduce migration from Mexico, India, and China, which send the largest numbers of immigrants each year, often to reunify families. So I think that there is a question of the balance between family reunification and skills migration. And at the same time, it's not to say that just because you're immigrating here as a family member that you don't have merit, because you may have a lot of skills as well as the family connection. But the Trump administration and some members of Congress want to focus more on employment and high skills, English language abilities, and in some ways to try to narrow the racial and cultural composition of the immigrant stream.
David Kyle.
Well, I've been giving this quite a bit of thought recently in a somewhat broader frame, in that we've had traditionally what was known as negative eugenics versus positive eugenics. Negative eugenics are all of the evil things that we know that have been committed in the name of racism, sterilization, concentration camps, and the rest. Positive eugenics was simply saying that the smart people should marry other smart people and have children, or smart people should be in our institutions, or smart people should come into the country. That's always been, in fact, that was the initial idea behind eugenics when Sir Francis Galton started it in the 1860s, built on research called hereditary genius, and he talked about things like talent as merit. Fast forward to 2018, I think that this is the Rorschach test of our time, and that when Trump says, I believe the phrase was countries, he was specifically talking about Africa and Haiti. He said, why do we have so many, or any at all, basically, from these countries? Why can't we have more Norwegians? Now, one half of the country just view that as patently racist. The other half, and it may or may not be a dog whistle, but the other half is, no, this is about skills or merit. And I think that this is a bigger conversation about how this ideology of merit and talent has gotten out of control. And that it's precisely the kind of thing that's sparking so much anxiety among Trump voters, is that their own feeling about whether they are useful. Well, do they have useful talents? Will their children have useful talents? This is the kind of core anxiety. And so of course, there's the scapegoating happening, but the ideology of a kind of positive eugenics and merit-based, that's actually a wider ideology that whether you're in Silicon Valley or Kansas or Alabama, you know, people don't see a problem with that. I see this as two sides of the same coin, one feeding the other, kind of what I call talentism, that is sort of the oxygen supply of racism. So we can talk about Norwegians, and while, you know, when you link it to the countries, that seems obviously racist. But the fact that we can do that and talk about merit, which is not a new idea, not a new program, I think the two are connected, and I think we need to get that some more thought. You know, by the way, Melania got here on a so-called genius visa. Always something like this, where if you're super talented, you've won the Nobel Prize, et cetera, something like that, and or you invest in the U.S. And what this turns into is simply not just merit, but high-value individuals, and becomes its own class. And I think, once again, it becomes another form, a hidden form of not only racism, but all kinds of discrimination. And it's that high-end worshiping of particular people and the notion of merit that's running throughout our society. That's actually feeding into the idea that you could just talk about people on the bottom end as literally animals. They're all criminals, et cetera. By the way, I actually checked on this just yesterday. Turns out Norway has gangs also.
You've said a lot there, and I think that the United States is probably not unique in having this, what you're now calling talentism. New Zealand, we have given a citizenship to the billionaire Peter Thiel before he ever lived here. There are a lot of concerns about this type of thing. It's an interesting, potentially global phenomenon. Kevin Johnson.
I mean, I think we've seen similar arguments and discussions of affirmative action in higher education. What is merit? What should we consider in the admissions process? And there are a lot of social anxieties that come into play there about access and inclusion and who gets what. But I do think that it's important to keep in mind that merit is a contested concept. It means different things to different people. And I think that it's you know, may, perhaps if you're talking about, you know, the genius visa category, which usually goes to, not always, but usually goes to athletes more so than, you know, and actors and actresses in the United States. I think we should have a discussion of what, you know, merit might be. And we should also think carefully about, you know, whether people who are working people, you know, should be admitted and how that benefits the economy as a whole.
I'd like to turn a little bit to the legal issues in terms of what kind of legal ground do people have who have been put in these detention centers. I know there were some lawsuits between some organizations and the Trump administration. There were Sanctuary City lawsuits that were going on. Can you walk us through that side of it?
Yeah, there have been immigrant detention lawsuits as long as there's been immigrant detention. And we've had some lawsuits that have been enforced and still are in effect after 20 years or so. And in response to the recent immigrant detention policies of the administration, there are new lawsuits. And there is going to be a resolution at some point, perhaps by the U.S. Supreme Court, with respect to detention, whether indefinite detention can be constitutional or not. In fact, the Supreme Court in a case in 2018 sent back to a lower court a case that squarely raises the question of whether or not indefinite detention of an immigrant while the proceeding is pending is constitutional. It's a case called Jennings versus Rodriguez. And I think that there's a whole lineup of cases challenging immigrant detention, challenging separation of families, challenging the conditions of detention, challenging the medical care provided to detainees, challenging the psychological care provided to detainees. There's a whole array of different challenges that are ongoing, and these will percolate their way through the system. In the past, what has happened is that these legal challenges have been successful in some ways, have required the president at the time to change the policies in certain ways, to provide bond hearings, for example, allow some people to be released. I assume that there'll be some victories and some losses for the Trump administration when it comes to immigrant detention. And I think that it's going to be a long and contested sort of battle. I do think that in the very near future, we're going to get a resolution from the Supreme Court about whether something like indefinite detention of non-citizens awaiting their immigration proceedings to go forward is constitutional. We do have a system where citizens can never be held indefinitely without a possibility of a bond hearing and possible release from custody. But we have an immigration system where certain groups of non-citizens can be held indefinitely without a bond hearing. And the Trump administration has made it very clear that they want to end what they call catch and release of detainees. They want to ensure that people stay in custody. And some would say what they want to do is they want to encourage them to forego their right to a hearing and agree to deportation because the prospect of staying in indefinite detention is so unpleasant and painful that they just can't deal with it.
The other thing I wanted to get to, David Kyle, with you is, you know, you've studied also the sort of underground aspect of migration and smuggling and that sort of a thing. And I seem to remember in your work something about how when all these borders get closed in a place like the United States, it actually gives rise to more of this really dangerous underground stuff going on. What can you tell us about that?
Well, smuggling is a function of people wanting a good, a commodity, a service to do something that the state has stopped. When we think of prohibition as the perfect example of that. So what happens, though, in the case of people smuggling is that the border simply makes it a little more difficult and at least the perception of being more difficult. And that simply means that the smuggling fees can go up. As the smuggling fees go up, that's actually what attracts criminal organizations, that kind of phenomena. The profits go up, it starts to change the organization. So you do get more, a little bit more criminal syndicate activity. The only thing I would add to that is that I would not automatically assume, though, that a wall would mean that we are going to see more criminal syndicates. I believe that there are lots of creative ways to get into the United States, overstay visas, document forgery, many, many ways to do it other than just crossing the border. I think that's the other problem with the wall, is that it's not just, okay, so how do we get over or under the wall now? We've had a wall in most of the border for a long time now, and we can kind of know what to expect on that front. What we probably will see are other very different creative strategies that I believe are essentially endless.
If, in fact, the smuggling does sort of get a boost, shall we say, as a result of these policies and a wall. Now, I understand that this world is pretty harrowing and pretty abusive. What do we not see? What's not in the spotlight? What do we not know?
In terms of the immigrant journey?
The immigrant journey, the process, what they go through, what they have to pay.
I think that what we kind of know, but we don't fully appreciate, are the conditions in the home communities or home countries that they're leaving. And I think playing around, and Kevin can probably speak more to this than I can in terms of language, but the legal categories around refugee versus economic migrant, this is not self-ID. This is determined by state or perhaps in the first moment that you cross the border. No matter what you say is happening, that label is sort of what matters. And I think that the side effect of that is that by the time, you know, downstream, the news story is that these are not refugees, or the focus is no longer on the home community. So, for example, Honduras, where many of them are coming from, has, I believe, the highest homicide rate in the hemisphere, one of the highest in the world. I don't see a lot of coverage of really the facts on the ground. What exactly are they going through? These are people that are very upfront that just can't live there anymore. And in the other normal universe, they would be refugees and we would be taking them in and providing shelter. I don't see that being covered.
And you're saying that, say, for example, Honduras, if they stay there, the chances of them staying alive are pretty slim.
Their odds of being killed or hurt are higher than any normal American would be willing to risk. I think it's telling that I believe the Trump administration is proposing, maybe something about this, proposing that as an asylum seeker, the threat of violence is being taken off the table, or it's being proposed that that can't be one of the things that is the threat. I think that that's very telling about what the links to which this administration will go to.
Kevin Johnson.
I think that it is important that, as David mentioned, that these people who are currently coming across the southern border from Central America are fleeing horrendous conditions of violence, as well as economic problems as well. And that some of the women bringing children are bringing their children to try to save their lives. And we oftentimes don't pay as much attention to the human conditions that they fled that make them willing to take a dangerous and possibly disastrous journey across the deserts into the United States. I mean, women who make that journey are regularly raped and abused in horrible and horrendous ways. I've heard stories of women taking birth control before they make the journey, knowing that they were going to be raped along that journey. And you have to imagine what would drive somebody to take that kind of risk, perhaps with children. And you have to think that they're fleeing some pretty horrendous things. And by all accounts, it appears that the conditions in El Salvador and Honduras are horribly violent, particularly for certain groups of people. And I do think that people in the United States don't necessarily have a good idea of the risk taken by the migrants who risk everything, literally everything, trying to make it to the United States, those who do cross the border without inspection. And I think that we should pay more attention to the fact that we have people dying each and every day along the U.S.-Mexico border, that we, in part as a nation, are responsible for that by making border fortifications that make and redirect migrant streams to more dangerous locations where they're more likely to die, and where in some places along the border, they don't have enough storage space to keep all the bodies. It's really a story that is deeply troubling to anybody who cares about the humanity of people who are fleeing horrible conditions. And I do think that even President Trump, when he talks about MS-13 and the crime in El Salvador, understands that the violence there is horrible. At the same time, his administration is denying people access to even applying for relief in the United States. We're not talking about getting relief. And now Attorney General Sessions, just earlier this week, has made it clear that it's not going to be that easy to get relief if you're claiming persecution by private parties like gangs or the husband of a spousal batterer. So I think that we have an administration that is trying to make it tougher to get here, is harsher to people who flee this violence, and then doesn't want to give relief to people who fled this violence, even though it seems to be required by U.S. law.
What can possibly be done on either end of this? David, Kyle, what do you think?
That's a tough one in that there is what could be done and then what I think, could be done politically. I think that really more education, understanding, communication with people across the Western Hemisphere is necessary. I think there's just such a lack of awareness of each other's lives and the interdependency. I think that everybody has been put into boxes in the U.S. in terms of who you are, what you can do, your community, your state. I think that the social Darwinian dimension of the United States in general has increased so much that we can't look up from our cubicles, from our communities. We want to be passionate. I think that Americans want to do the right thing. They want to figure it out. I think it has more to do with the nature of where our culture has been going recently, the technology. But also, as I said, I think there's this social Darwinian aspect that's creeping up on us again and getting a little bit out of balance such that Why would I even want to know about somebody in Jalisco? However, we might not be talking about globalization as much, but we are still just as connected. The interdependency is still very much there.
Kevin Johnson?
I would think of it in two ways. One is, you know, we are seeing something of a political reaction to at least the separation of families, and also with respect to the treatment of the recipients of the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program. And so one of the things that I view as being a possibility, not a certainty, but at this point in time, with the Trump administration taking extremely aggressive actions with respect to immigrants, we are seeing a political reaction to that. And it includes not simply Democrats who have a particular political bent on immigration. I think we're starting to see Republicans, including moderate Republicans, are pushing for some kind of response when it comes to family separation and also respect to the DACA recipients. So I guess I'm optimistic in the sense that at some point, there'll be a political response, at least to some of these problems. And I'm hopeful that the long-term sort of political solution is going to be just that. It's going to take a lot longer for us to come up with a system of immigration laws that balance all the different things we've been talking about in terms of, you know, merit versus families, the rights and status and economic impacts on U.S. citizens, and the humanitarian treatment of people. I think that's going to take a lot longer to come about. In the interim, I do think we're going to see, and actually we've seen an incredible amount of litigation and legal challenges to the various immigration policies of the Trump administration. The travel ban on Muslims, which you really haven't talked about, were you know, the third sort of version of the travel ban. The first two were struck down, and the third one might survive, or parts of it might survive, but might not. It's currently before the U.S. Supreme Court. But that's just the tip of the iceberg in terms of litigation. I mean, the state of California is probably more than 10 lawsuits challenging various immigration policies. And I do think that at a minimum is going to slow things down. In some respects, it's going to stop things from going into place. So I think there will be political responses. I think there will be legal responses. But I do think in the short term, there's certainly going to be a lot of human misery. And it's, in my mind, unfortunate.
Well, gentlemen, I thank you for joining us once again here on the Scholar Circle.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you very much.
Kevin Johnson is Dean and Professor of Public Interest Law at the University of California, Davis Law School. His books include Opening the Floodgates, Why America Needs to Rethink Its Borders and Immigration Laws, and Immigration Law and the U.S.-Mexico Border. David Kyle is a professor of sociology at the University of California, Davis. His publications include Global Human Smuggling, Comparative Perspectives, and Transnational Peasants, Migrations, Networks, and Ethnicity in Andean Ecuador.
And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Anais Amin, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page. Most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.